As I said earlier, for the rest of the term, we'll be talking about DNA in one way or another, starting with this first chapter in Unit 4. This first chapter is about the cell cycle and cell division. And in the opening slide, we can see three major purposes for cell division. Cell division, of course, is when a cell divides. And one major use of that is for reproduction. Now, if you are a unicellular organism, then cell division is reproduction. It's the entire process, really, because a unicellular organism is a bit different from us. It consists of one cell. That's a big difference in itself. But when a unicellular organism reproduces, it simply splits into two. And so the original organism, the parent, is no longer there. It's replaced by two new cells, which are its offspring. But cell division is also important for reproduction in us multicellular organisms. Because in sexual species, like animals and plants and others, the initial cell, the zygote that's created as when fertilization happens, that doesn't stay as a zygote. It splits using cell division to become two cells, and then four, and then eight, and eventually you're 100 trillion cells in your case. So cell division isn't the entire process of reproduction in multicellular organisms, but it's involved. Next, we have growth and development, which are two things, obviously, but they're lumped together. Growth is an increase in size, of course. And that actually goes for both unicellular and multicellular organisms as well. A unicellular organism does grow. And this should make sense when you think about how they're created, which I was just talking about. A unicellular organism comes into existence when its parent split into two cells. Well, when that parent splits into two cells, at that moment, of course, neither of those two cells is going to be as big as the cell that just split into two, right? They're going to be roughly half that size. So even individual cells grow to a certain extent. But really, cell division is much more important in terms of growth for multicellular organisms. We've already talked about the constraint put on cell size by surface area to volume ratio, right? We've been through that. And so huge organisms like humans or even bigger things are huge not because they're made up of a huge cell, that would be impossible, but because they make their bodies out of trillions of individually small cells, each of which is created by cell division events. Development is related, but development doesn't refer to increase in size. It refers to specialization of functions along the way. So we are not just a lump of 100,000 cells that are identical to the original zygote, 100 trillion. Instead, along the way, cells, after they're created, develop in a certain trajectory. They become specialized for a certain function. So there are we have all kinds of different types of cells, neurons, muscle cells, and so on. That's what development refers to. Tissue renewal is the third, as you see. And this, of course, does not apply to unicellular organisms because unicellular organisms don't have tissues. Remember where tissues is in the hierarchy of biological organization, from atoms all the way up to the biosphere. Remember I said that unicellular organisms skip a few of those steps in the hierarchy? Well, tissues is one of those. Tissues are groups of cells specializing in a certain function, like muscle tissue or epithelial tissue. And tissue renewal refers to repairing things. So we, as multicellular organisms, lose billions of cells every day. They die, get worn off, slough off of us. From the skin, for instance, we lose billions of red blood cells every day. But we also can, that's just normal. We also, though, every once in a while, injure our cells, injure our bodies, which involves millions of cells, even a tiny cut. So there are a certain number of cells that die in that process, but the surviving cells surrounding that area of injury then are spurred into undergoing cell division to create new cells that can replace the ones that are lost from the injury. And that, of course, is important in a multicellular organism. We heal because of cell division. All right, slide 2 is a picture of a cell. Hopefully that's obvious. It should also, at this point, be obvious to you which type of cell it is in the dichotomy of cell types. What would you say? It is what? Why would you say eukaryotic? Which is true.
Well, it seems like...
Right. There, this is the overall cell. This part in the middle is the nucleus. And, of course, a prokaryotic cell doesn't have a nucleus. So, yes, this is a eukaryotic cell, and that's what we're going to focus on for most of the chapter. But even more specifically, I can tell by looking at this that it is a eukaryotic cell that doesn't have much longer to live as this cell. In other words, this is a eukaryotic cell that is not far from dividing into two cells. And the reason I know that is because of what's going on in the nucleus. If this were a eukaryotic cell that was just recently created, we would see the nucleus, but we wouldn't see these strands that are in here. It would just more or less be a one-color background, whatever, in the nucleus. We wouldn't see these rope-like structures that we see here. Even though that stuff would be there, it just would be not visible as tightly wound strands. When you think back to the survey of the cell, the tour of the cell chapter, what did I say is the major content of a eukaryotic nucleus? What's in there? DNA, but not just naked DNA. DNA is packaged in what material? No, genes are part of DNA. So that's going to smaller detail. I'm talking about a bigger detail. It's not just DNA by itself that appears in the nucleus. DNA is complexed together with a bunch of proteins. And what did I say we call this overall mixture of DNA and proteins? No, that's the nuclear envelope is the membrane surrounding all of this. The material, the chief material within a eukaryotic nucleus is chromatin. Chromatin is the mixture I was talking about. Chromatin consists of DNA and proteins. And chromatin is there, even in a brand new cell, one that was just created by cell division. But the chromatin we see here is starting to condense, to tighten up into what eventually we will call chromosomes. It's not because material is being added. It's just that that existing material is becoming more and more condensed so that we can see... Well, right now you can't tell how many chromosomes there are, right? It just looks like one long piece of spaghetti. It's really several pieces. But because it's not condensed fully yet, you can't tell how many there are. And that's why we don't call these things chromosomes yet, even though all the material is there. We just call it chromatin. And this chromatin is in the process of condensing. When it condenses to the point that we actually can see individual pieces, that's when we change the name to chromosomes, and each individual piece, which is still DNA and protein, but it's just one DNA, one long double DNA helix, double helix DNA, plus a bunch of proteins, that's one chromosome. We have some number of chromosomes here, though. We still call it chromatin because we can't see individual chromosomes yet. But because that condensing of the chromatin has started, that's why I know this cell isn't long for being this cell. It's about to undergo cell division, which will mean this one no longer exists, and the two cells it becomes will replace it. That's an important part of the cell cycle. So if we go to slide 3, we can see a photomicrograph on the left edge of just one chromosome. And so this is not just DNA, as I said. A chromosome is DNA plus a bunch of proteins. And those proteins are called histones. We'll talk more about them later. But this is a real photograph of just one in a human. This is taken from a human cell, but they would look similar in other organisms. Now, even though this is called one chromosome, it's really enough material to be two chromosomes. It's enough to be two copies of a chromosome, one for each of two cells. But we call it one chromosome because those two copies in the DNA part of those two copies are identical. Those two copies are still connected. That's why we consider it to be one chromosome. But because it contains enough material for two, we call it a replicated chromosome. It's a single chromosome technically, but it's a replicated chromosome. And those two copies, two halves of the replicated chromosome, each of those is called a chromatid. Be careful because there are several words that have similar spellings. Chromatid is different from chromatin. Chromatin is the stuff that chromatids are made out of. But each of these vertical halves of this overall replicated chromosome is a chromatid. And since they are identical to each other and connected to each other, they're called sister chromatids. Has nothing to do with gender, it's just what we chose to call them. Okay? So one replicated chromosome consists of two identical sister chromatids. Well, at least the DNA is identical. The proteins aren't necessarily identical. And the specific place along the length of the replicated chromosome at which the two sister chromatids are connected, which is why it's still considered one chromosome, is called the centromere. So, a replicated chromosome comes into view eventually, as you know, we don't, like I said before, we don't call something a chromosome until we can see it as an individual thing, which doesn't happen until that loose chromatin gets tightly condensed, wound up tightly, basically, so that we can see it as an individual thing. Nothing new is added. But a replicated chromosome doesn't come into view until it is already replicated. And so now I need to pause, since we're talking about replication, and say that DNA overall, in whatever organism, DNA has two major functions. And I likely have said this before, I don't remember whether I did or not. Does anyone know the two functions of DNA? Do you remember me even talking about this in week one? So I did mention it. Okay. There's two major functions of DNA in any given cell. One of those is replication. Replication refers to making a copy of itself. And that's what's... this is what allows for life, which is just a continuation of making copies of DNA for, that's been happening for 4 billion years. And we'll see why DNA molecularly is ideally suited for replication. But replication refers to DNA making a copy of itself, and now you have two identical DNA molecules. All right, that's really important if you want to have cell division, or more specifically, if you want a cell to divide. Yeah, you could do that. But if you want those two cells to live, to be viable, then each of them needs not only DNA, but they need all of the DNA that the original cell had. Well, you can't give two things all of your DNA unless you first make a copy of what you have, so you have two identical copies. One of each you give to each of the two daughter cells, as they're called. Does that make sense? So before a cell can divide successfully, it first has to undergo DNA replication. That's one of the two major functions of DNA. And that's the function of DNA that this chapter is focused on. We'll study the other major function of DNA in a different chapter in detail, but what is that other function? If you don't remember me explicitly saying it, just what do you have a feel for based on just common knowledge of DNA?
Information.
It is, yes, the other function definitely uses the informational aspect of DNA. But what specifically is the function? To what? Indirectly, yes. It's an indirect process because a gene, which is a piece of DNA, is a code not for directly how to make proteins, but for how to indirectly make proteins. It's a code, the DNA, the gene, is a code for how to directly make an RNA, which is a different kind of nucleic acid, right? They're both informational molecules. DNA codes for production of RNA, and then RNA codes for the production of protein, of polypeptide. And that overall process, which is two steps, two major steps, is called gene expression. When a gene is expressed, both of these steps occur. Using the DNA information to make an RNA, specifically a messenger RNA, and then using the messenger RNA in a second step to produce a polypeptide. Well, what is that first step? Using DNA to make a messenger RNA, or to make an RNA of any type, really. What is that called? The first part of gene expression. I told you first about it when we were on a slide that I told you was at the cusp between proteins, which we were looking at, and then nucleic acids, which the rest of the slideshow was about. The first step of gene expression is called transcription. And that's the second major function of DNA. Replication is one. That's what we'll look at in this chapter. Transcription is the other. And transcription does not result in a polypeptide directly. Transcription results in an RNA molecule, and DNA's job is done at that point because it hands the information off to the RNA, and then the RNA goes on to the second part, which is translation. We'll look at that in another chapter, and that's when the polypeptide gets built. Any questions on all of that? Okay, let's go back to this slide 3 then. Continue looking at this replicated chromosome. The cartoon cells in the middle, which are easy to look at as cartoons, are really not telling you the truth.
Because at the top of the cell, there is an unreplicated chromosome.
Right? It doesn't have an identical half connected to it. It has not yet been replicated. So this is a chromosome that's just enough material to be for one cell. And the reason it's a lie, in a sense, is because you wouldn't see this as a chromosome. It would just be diffuse chromatin spread out. You wouldn't see any object there. It would just be a background grayness if you looked at it under a microscope. Okay? Before any condensing happens, replication happens. So while it's still diffuse, the chromatin that is, that's when replication occurs. And it has to do that. Actually, both of the major functions that I just went over for DNA, both of those have to happen when the DNA is loose, not tightly wound up. Because if it's tightly wound up, you can't get in there and read the sequence of nucleotides, the information on it. And both of these functions of DNA require that information, the actual sequence of nucleotides that make up the DNA. If you can't read it because it's tightly wound up, then you can't do either of these things. So that's why you don't see an unreplicated chromosome. Instead, it would be just chromatin. And then, as it prepares to divide, it first has to replicate that chromatin. That happens while it's still diffuse. Okay? And then, after it is replicated, it will condense into a point where you can actually see it. So this middle one's not a lie. By the time you see it as a chromosome, it's already replicated, as is my point here. And that's why this is a true photograph. You don't have a photograph for this because it wouldn't really exist in that state. Okay, but once you have replication taking place and everything goes well, hopefully, then the cell basically ends its own life by splitting into two cells. And each of those two cells gets one of those two sister chromatids. Obviously, they split apart. And so this is also part of this word game we're playing. Once the sister chromatids split apart, they are no longer called chromatids. Each of them is then, now that it's on its own, fully a chromosome in its own right. It's just now going to be an unreplicated chromosome, and it's going to be in its own cell compared to the other one that used to be connected to. That's the general scheme of how eukaryotic cell division occurs. On the right edge, you see what's happening at the DNA. So we're ignoring the proteins that are part of chromatin. An unreplicated chromosome has one enormously long double-stranded DNA. A replicated chromosome has two sister chromatids, each of which has that same DNA. They're identical to each other. And then back to unreplicated in the next generation of cells. Okay, now to four. We're looking at the overall cell cycle. One turn of this is one cell cycle, which is one cell lifetime. Even in your own body, individual cells have lifetimes that vary greatly depending on what kind of cell it is. For instance, a neuron can last your entire lifetime. But a blood cell, only 10, 20 days. Skin cells, very short-lived. So each cell has its own lifetime, but if it doesn't get killed, if it survives, one turn through the cell cycle is that particular cell's lifetime. And if it does make it to the end, like I said before, it splits into two. Its own life is over, but that creates two new cells, each of which starts its own cell cycle for one turn, or at least one partial turn. Okay, now, what you see on the outer edge of this in teal and yellow, actually, teal and yellow, but the outer ring,
is that the overall cell cycle has two major subdivisions,
one of which is interphase.
That's by far the longest part, or longer part.
And the other part of the cell cycle is the mitotic phase, or M phase for short. Now, the phrase mitotic phase is potentially confusing, because mitotic is just the adjective of the word mitosis, but the mitotic phase is not just another name for mitosis. The mitotic phase includes mitosis, but mitosis is only part of the mitotic phase. It includes more than mitosis, in other words. As you see, the other part of the mitotic phase is cytokinesis. Now, the mitotic phase is, overall, eukaryotic cell division. So we're talking about eukaryotic cells here, ones that have a nucleus. And since a eukaryotic cell has a nucleus, there are two major things that need to be divided if that type of cell divides. Specifically, a eukaryotic cell needs to divide its nucleus and the contents, and it needs to divide everything else, collectively the cytoplasm and the organelles that are in that cytoplasm. All right? Well, one of those two divisions or division events needs to be much more careful than the other if there's any hope of the two resulting cells being viable, being able to live. Which of those two division events needs to be more careful? Division of the nucleus, because that involves the DNA. And what I mean here is that a given eukaryotic species has a certain number of chromosomes. What that number is just depends on the species. But however many chromosomes there are, a cell has that many chromosomes, which make up, for that species, the entire genetic library. Those chromosomes contain however many genes that cell has, that species has. All right? Well, those genes are indirect codes for how to build the proteins, and proteins are things you can't live without, right? Proteins do so many important things. That's why you need a library, the genes, to tell the cell how to build those proteins. So if the reason I'm saying you have to be careful here is if you're trying to make two new cells by splitting yourself, you have to give each of those two cells DNA, but you can't just say, well, looks like about half. You take this and you take the rest. You have to be very careful to say you get exactly one copy of the library I just replicated. In other words, you get the full library, and this other cell, you also get the full library, just the other copy. That has to be much more careful than splitting the rest of the cell, which is the cytoplasm, because then you can roughly say, well, this looks like about half, this looks like about half. The reason that doesn't have to be nearly as careful is if you don't get something, you know, if you short one of the cells, some cytoplasm, which is made up of a bunch of proteins anyway, you still have a library to go to build those proteins if you need them. So mitosis is just part of eukaryotic cell division. It is specifically division of the nucleus. Don't think of mitosis as being another name for eukaryotic cell division. It's only part of it. It's division of the nucleus and its contents. Cytokinesis is the other part of eukaryotic cell division, and it's division of everything other than the nucleus, the collective cytoplasm. And only if they both happen, which they usually do, but some there's exceptions. Sometimes a cell will do one without the other. Only if they both happen, though, in a eukaryotic cell, will you have two new cells, each with a nucleus that contains all of the DNA that the original cell did. Of course, that can't happen unless replication occurs first. Okay, so that interphase plus the M phase make up one cell cycle in a eukaryote. Those are the major subdivisions. Let's look at the inside, though, because each of these major subdivisions has divisions. Interphase is split into three divisions, and in the order in which they happen, as you see here, they are G1, S, and G2. The G's here, both 1 and 2, stand for gap. And that's kind of unfortunate. It's a misnomer, really, because calling these things gaps kind of implies that nothing's happening. Well, that's not true at all. It's just that you don't really see much happening under a light microscope. That's why they called them gaps. G1, though, is the first one. It's the first part of interphase. And G1 you can think of as being the normal lifetime of whatever kind of cell it is. It spends its normal lifetime before it starts thinking about dividing, ending its own life. It's busy being whatever kind of cell it is, producing whatever kind of proteins it needs to produce to do those jobs. That happens in G1. Now, when it gets a signal, and we'll talk about those signals later, that it is time to prepare for splitting into two, to end its own life of being whatever kind of cell it is, and create two new ones, then it transitions to the second part of interphase, which is the S phase. S here stands for synthesis, production of new stuff. Well, specifically, it's DNA synthesis. So, in other words, the S phase of interphase is when that one of the two major jobs of DNA takes place, replication. The S phase features DNA replication. The DNA synthesis, creation of new DNA, happens in a way that whatever DNA is there in its cell originally gets identically copied. So there are two sets. Or more correctly, I should say, that however many chromosomes there are, they turn into replicated chromosomes, which is really enough for two cells. That happens in S. While the chromatin that includes that DNA is still diffuse, it's not tightly wound up yet. Replication occurs, has to occur when it's loose, because loose DNA is readable as far as the code is concerned. Okay, then you get to G2. It's not a gap either. There's all kinds of things happening in a cell during G2. But by G2, it's already been through synthesis, the S phase. It's already been through replication. So this cell has already been preparing to divide. And G2 is really just includes the events that, after DNA replication has occurred, that fully prepare this cell for actually splitting. So it's done doing its job, whatever kind of cell it was. That was in G1. Now it's in G2. It's preparing to become two cells. But it's already doubled its DNA. All right, those three make up interphase. The mitotic phase, as I already said, consists of mitosis and cytokinesis. Mitosis, division of the nucleus. Cytokinesis, division of the cytoplasm. But notice that unlike the divisions between interphase subphases like G1 to S, which feature these dark black lines, because there's like a stark difference, there is no black line between mitosis and cytokinesis here. It kind of fades from one shade of yellow to another, and that's intentional. What the artist was trying to convey here is that in a eukaryotic cell, mitosis does not come to go to completion before cytokinesis begins. There are different processes doing different things, but they overlap in time. Mitosis starts first, but cytokinesis starts before mitosis ends. They overlap. All right, well, let's look at 5 then, which shows you that mitosis itself, which is already a subdivision of one of the subdivisions of the cell cycle, mitosis itself is then subdivided. It's divided into 5 phases. Well, we're looking at 6 pictures here, and that's because this slide shows you a little bit more than just mitosis. These go in order as they occur from left to right, but notice that this first one is labeled G2 of interphase. So this is before mitosis, really. Interphase is before the M phase, and M phase includes mitosis. The reason that we're starting with a picture that's not yet to mitosis is so that we can compare what's happening in it to what's happening once we officially get to mitosis. And the top ones, even though they're colorized, are real photomicrographs. So that's what you would see if you really looked at it through a microscope. But it's much better to learn these things by just looking at the cartoons, because they're drawn in a way that can help you understand these major features of each step. So before we get to mitosis, then let's look at what the status is in G2 of interphase, the end of interphase, in other words. Well, one thing is that in addition to the... Well, let me say something else first. G2, remember, from the previous slide, is after S. So we're already looking at a cell that's been through S. And in addition to DNA of chromosomes, or of chromatin, being replicated in the S phase, the centrosome also gets replicated. That's outside of the nucleus. Now, we've talked about the centrosome before. I told you that eukaryotes have centrosomes, but in animals, which are just one type of eukaryote, the centrosomes contain centrioles, 2 centrioles in this T shape, right? That looked like licorice in a different slide. Remember, I told you those are the things that we really haven't figured out what they do yet. So we're looking at an animal cell here that you can tell that basically by the centrioles that are in the centrosomes. But a cell starts out with 1 centrosome, and it's 2 centrioles making 1 T. When it goes through S, which we've already been through, not only does the chromatin get doubled because of replication, but also the centrosome replicates. So now there are 2 centrosomes out in the cytoplasm, and those 2 centrosomes are right next to each other. In the nucleus, we see chromatin. Obviously, you can't tell how many chromosomes there are, which is why we don't use the word chromosomes yet. But this is not completely loose chromatin. If you look closely enough, and you might not see it from where you are, you're starting to see some strands. So this is early condensing of the chromatin into visible strands, but it hasn't gone too far. Also notice that the nuclear envelope is fully intact. Okay, now, let's go into the first subphase of mitosis, which is prophase, and compare what's happening here. One thing that's happening out in the cytoplasm that's important is that these 2 centrosomes are starting to polarize, by which I mean they're moving apart from each other. They're moving to opposite ends or poles of the cell. They were right next to each other before. And the reason that the thing that's moving them from each other is that each centrosome, remember that centrosomes are microtubule organizing centers, right? So microtubules grow from centrosomes. And they're growing
from each centrosome pushing on each other, so forcing the two centrosomes to opposite poles. They haven't gotten completely polarized. They're not at opposite ends yet, but they're moving away from each other in prophase of mitosis. In the nucleus, meanwhile, there's been some developments. The nuclear envelope is still intact, importantly, in prophase. But inside the nucleus, you can see that there is much more condensing of chromatin that has occurred. And we still don't really know for sure how many chromosomes there are, but we're getting close to be able to officially call these chromosomes, because we're starting to see them being separate from each other rather than just one long tangle. Okay, then we go to the next mitotic phase, which is, the next subphase of mitosis, which is prometaphase. Well, the polarization of the two centrosomes is now complete. They are fully at opposite ends. And we see that the structure formed by these microtubules and the centrosomes is nearly complete. This structure, which consists of the two centrosomes plus all of the microtubules growing from those two centrosomes, is called the mitotic spindle. A spindle is something that is tapers at the ends and is wider in the middle. So the mitotic spindle is spindle-shaped, or football-shaped in a sense. You can see that right here. See how they're coming to tips? It's called the mitotic spindle because it's involved in nuclear division, which is what mitosis is. Okay, but as far as the nucleus is concerned, importantly, what's happened here is that the nuclear envelope is no longer intact. It has disintegrated. So, really, technically speaking, this cell does not have a nucleus at the moment, because the nuclear envelope defines the nucleus. Why would a cell do this? Well, because the reason that the mitotic spindle is forming is so that some of those microtubules that are part of the mitotic spindle can connect to individual replicated chromosomes. Well, the replicated chromosomes are inside the nucleus, and the mitotic spindle and its microtubules are out in the cytoplasm. That's two different compartments. In other words, the nuclear envelope is in the way. It will prevent connection of microtubules to replicated chromosomes, and therefore it gets disintegrated to get it out of the way. Look at the chromosomes, though. At this point, there is much more condensing, and now we actually can officially call these things chromosomes, because we can see they are separate from each other. We can see how many there are. But they are not just chromosomes. They are replicated chromosomes, as I said, because you can see that each one consists of two sister chromatids hooked together at a centromere, just like in that photomicrograph of a couple slides ago. Now, we need to distinguish two functional categories of microtubules in the mitotic spindle. Molecularly speaking, all microtubules are identical. But there's two categories of microtubules in a mitotic spindle based on what they're doing. That's why it's a functional distinction only. One type of microtubule is called a kinetochore microtubule. You probably don't see that spelling. Kinetochore microtubules are so called because they are the ones that actually do this connecting to chromosomes. And the specific place
on a replicated chromosome where the connection is made with the microtubule is called the kinetochore. Well, there's a kinetochore for each sister chromatid. In other words, there's two kinetochores per replicated chromosome, right? One half is a sister chromatid. And the kinetochores in this cartoon are indicated by these little black dots right at the centromere, which is the connection point between the two sister chromatids. Keeping track of all this language? There's a lot of similar words, as I said. Okay? So the two purple halves of one replicated chromosome, those are the two sister chromatids. The place where they're connected is the centromere. The black dots, one for each sister chromatid, also at that centromere, are called kinetochores. And they are protein complexes that allow for the microtubules, specifically the kinetochore microtubules, to connect. The other category of microtubules in the spindle are called either non-kinetochore microtubules, because they aren't kinetochore microtubules, they don't connect to kinetochores, but they can also be called, in other books, polar microtubules. Non-kinetochore or polar microtubules are the ones that were already functioning a little earlier to polarize the two centrosomes. So they're not about connecting to kinetochores. They're about pushing on each other from opposite centrosomes to move those two centrosomes to the opposite ends of the cell, to polarize them. That's why they're called polar microtubules by some books. They're both of those functions are important. All right, that's all the big deals about prometaphase. The next subphase of mitosis is metaphase. This also happens to be the shortest in time of the phases, because metaphase is defined as just the time during which all, however many there are, all of the replicated chromosomes, and however many there are just depends on the species. By the way, you can see here that there are six in this, right? In humans, it would be 46. But each species has its own number. Corn, more than us. Some things are fewer than us. Anyway, however many there are, those replicated chromosomes position themselves halfway between the two poles, the two centrosomes. So I don't want to say they line up, because they're not necessarily in a line. We're looking at a two-dimensional image of something that's really three-dimensional. So they can be anywhere in the plane that's halfway between the two poles. They don't have to be lined up. Okay? And by the way, that plane, which is just a... that's not a real object, it's just a mathematical idea. That plane is called either the metaphase plate, even though it's not really a structure, or you can call it the equatorial plane. But that metaphase plate, that imaginary mathematical plane, is halfway between the two poles. And that's where you find all the replicated chromosomes at metaphase. That's what defines it as metaphase. And also notice that the replicated chromosomes are even more condensed and therefore smaller than they were in prometaphase. This is another hallmark of metaphase. The degree of condensing of the chromatin is maximized at metaphase. In other words, at metaphase, chromosomes are as small as they'll ever be for that species. One thing I didn't really explicitly mention for prometaphase, but it also applies to metaphase, is that these kinetochore microtubules connect not just haphazardly to kinetochores, but in such a way that a kinetochore microtubule that's coming from one centrosome will attach to a kinetochore on one of the sister chromatids, and the other sister chromatid will attach to a kinetochore microtubule coming from the other centrosome. This is important because getting both of these connections made allows the chromosomes, which can be anywhere in prometaphase, anywhere in the cell, to be moved to this middle line, this middle plane, the metaphase plate. If the connections aren't made between the kinetochore microtubules and the replicated chromosomes, then those chromosomes aren't going to be able to get to the middle. They're forced to the middle. So it's important that one kinetochore microtubule from each of the two centrosomes is involved for that reason, to move them to the middle, but it's also important for what happens next. The next phase is anaphase. And the important thing, the defining feature of anaphase, is that these replicated chromosomes, each one is still considered one chromosome, like I said, it's a word game. Then the two things that make up the replicated chromosomes, the sister chromatids, split in anaphase. They are no longer connected to each other. And since they are no longer connected to each other, we stop calling them chromatids. And now each one is a chromosome in its own right. It's called a daughter chromosome. It just means it recently split from a replicated chromosome. These daughter chromosomes are not replicated because each one contains enough DNA for just one cell chromosome. All right? That's what anaphase is, that separation. And they not only separate, they start moving. Each daughter chromosome starts moving toward one pole, and the other daughter chromosome that it used to be connected to starts moving toward the other pole. These poles are the places where two new nuclei are going to be formed in the next step, in the next phase. But notice the important thing here. Each of these poles isn't just getting a random sampling of DNA. Each of them is getting all six, in this case, all six types of chromosomes, and the other one's getting all six as well. They're identical. In other words, both of the two cells is going to have a full library. It's not going to be missing any genes. Okay, the final step, this final subphase of mitosis, is telophase, but more than just telophase is shown here. This is labeled as telophase and cytokinesis because of what I said earlier about the overlap. Telophase describes just what's happening as far as the nucleus, the chromosomes, is concerned. Cytokinesis is starting to happen, though, too, and that involves this cytoplasm separation that's occurring as a cleavage furrow forms. That's not part of mitosis. That's cytokinesis. But for telophase, which is part of mitosis, what happens is that the daughter chromosomes, unreplicated, reach the pole they're going to, which is now a new nucleus, and a new nuclear envelope starts forming around each set, around each pole. Okay? So this cell, which is still one cell technically because cytokinesis hasn't completed yet, still technically one cell, it for the moment is going to have two nuclei, but only temporarily. Okay? And each nucleus contains a full library of unreplicated chromosomes. And notice also that even before this cell is two cells yet, each of the chromosomes in each nucleus is already starting to loosen up so that it can be used for the second purpose of DNA, which is transcription. You need to get, and that, you know, that you have to tighten things up to keep track of all the DNA, basically, to separate it into two cells. But as soon as you do that, you need to loosen it back up so that it can start being used for what genes are used for, which is transcription, so that the two cells resulting can make proteins. That's what transcription is involved in. Okay, so that's telophase and cytokinesis. They overlap, as I said. Cytokinesis finishes later after mitosis is done, but it starts before mitosis ends. In 6, we have a much better view of metaphase from where you're sitting. And this piece of glass is not real. That's just an imaginary mathematical plane called the metaphase plate. So it's not really a structure. But we can see here more of the 3D aspect I was talking about. These things don't necessarily line up. They are anywhere in the plane that is halfway between the two poles. And you also get a much better view of the two separate kinetochores, one for each of the two sister chromatids joined at a centromere. And one kinetochore is going to be bound with kinetochore microtubules from one pole, the other one with microtubules from the other pole. Only then can not only the splitting occur, but the driving them toward the opposite poles happen, which occurs in the step after metaphase, anaphase. Okay, 7 is the results of an experiment. Now, there could be any number of hypotheses you could devise, maybe, to describe how this movement of daughter chromosomes, the unreplicated ones, move toward the poles, away from each other. But 2 major hypotheses, each of which makes some sense, are that, you know, since we can see on a microscope, or before they figured it out what actually happens, they really didn't know the answer, they could see that these daughter chromosomes are connected to these kinetochore microtubules. So one hypothesis is more or less like a fishing line. In other words, it's kind of like hooking a fish, kinetochore hooking a daughter chromosome, and then you reel the kinetochore in, just like you reel in the line of the fishing line, and that drags the fish toward you. That makes sense and could happen. The other possibility, though, is that these microtubules, once they are connected, do what microtubules are famous for, which are serving as little roadways, right, along which things can be moved. So it could be that instead of reeling them in, the microtubules are laid down as roads, and then the chromosomes move along them toward the pole. Well, to answer which of those is true, they devised an experiment in which they experimentally marked the mitotic spindle. They marked the kinetochore microtubules. It looks like they just took a black marker. They did it molecularly, of course. But it serves the same purpose as a black marker. They could see that mark, in other words. Now, if the fishing line hypothesis were true, then what you would expect is this yellow region between the mark and the chromosomes to remain there, and the mark and the chromosome should both move toward the pole, right? That's not what happened, though. In the roadway hypothesis, you would expect the mark to stay still, and you would expect the chromosomes to approach and eventually pass the mark as they go toward the pole. And that's exactly what they observed. So it is that second hypothesis that's true. And that makes sense based on what I told you about microtubules already. We talked about motor proteins walking one step at a time along the microtubules for other reasons. This is just another use of that same mechanism. So the kinetochore that is the connection point is a complex of proteins that includes motor proteins, the red things, that walk along the microtubules, dragging the daughter chromosome along with it. What confused people into thinking it was maybe the fishing line hypothesis is that this is unlike most roads. Most roads are built to be reused. This is a road that only has to be used one time. One trip for this particular vehicle that's going to go down this road, the chromosome itself, only needs to do that one time. So as soon as it passes any given part of this road, there's no reason for that road to still stay built. So it not only walks along it, as it passes, the now already used part of the road just gets dismantled one subunit at a time. And that's why it looked like it was reeling it in. All right, we just finished mitosis in an animal cell. In a plant, mitosis occurs pretty much the same. One structural difference is, as I've said, plants' centrosomes don't have centrioles in them, but we don't know what they do anyway, so that's just a difference we know about. How it happens, though, is the same in plants and animals. Cytokinesis, on the other hand, happens differently in animals and plants, and that's because of one of the major differences that we've already talked about. All cells, of course, by definition, have a plasma membrane, including animal cells, but animal cells have a plasma membrane, and that's their only covering. A plant cell has a plasma membrane, a flimsy device, and then exterior to that, a much thicker and more sturdy cell wall. Well, in animal cells, as we already saw, cytokinesis occurs by formation of what's called a cleavage furrow. A furrow is just a ditch. So when you look at this, it looks like a ditch is being built, being dug deeper and deeper. But now we can see molecular detail of how this happens. It involves, this is another use of actin microfilaments. Remember, we talked about these as part of the cytoskeleton. They're involved in various movements, like how your muscles contract. This is another use of them. It's more or less a belt or a drawstring. A loop of microfilament on the inside of the cell is acting like a belt. Now, typically we wear a belt on the outside of the pants, right? Through belt loops, though. Here, the belt loops are in the inner surface of the plasma membrane, and the loop of microfilament goes through them, and then overlaps itself to complete the loop. Well, that overlapping increases, making this circle smaller and smaller. And since they go through belt loops, that's dragging the middle of the cell into itself. That's how cytokinesis occurs in an animal. And as it proceeds, eventually it will just pinch entirely off. Then you officially have two separate cells, and since mitosis is already completed, each of those cells has a full nucleus identical to each other and identical to the one cell that started this whole process. Well, plants can't undergo cytokinesis, can't conduct cytokinesis this way. They can't form a cleavage furrow because of the sturdiness of the cell wall. Okay, so instead, they form eventually what's called a cell plate. But first, what forms, and this is forming in the region defined as the metaphase plate. Here it's vertically placed, but it's still the metaphase plate. It's between the two poles, right? Two nuclei. What happens is that little vesicles form. Now, we've already talked about vesicles of various types. They're little bags made out of membrane material. The contents of these vesicles is the stuff that cell wall is made out of, which is, for plants, mostly polysaccharide, cellulose. So you have a bunch of little bags, each containing cell wall material. And those bags get bigger and bigger because they're producing more and more cellulose within them. And so they're approaching each other as they grow, or they're growing. They're not really approaching each other. They're getting bigger, and their edges are approaching each other. Eventually, they will touch each other, and they're all made out of the same membrane material, so it fuses together into what is called a cell plate. Now, this cell plate is still entirely within this one cell. But you now have really what amounts to one very long vesicle. That's what the cell plate really is, in essence. And it will continue to get longer until the ends fuse with the plasma membrane of the cell, which is also made out of the same material. When that happens, notice that you now officially have two cells, because this side of what was the cell plate is going to be the part of the plasma membrane on this half of the cell. It's continuous with the rest of this plasma membrane. Same thing on the other side. And in between those two cells is the cell wall. So that's how cytokinesis happens in a plant. So just a little bit different from an animal cell. It achieves the same thing, though. Division of the cytoplasm. Slide 9 is just a series of photomicrographs to show you that it's not just us saying that it happens the same way, mitosis that is, as in an animal cell. These are actual photographs. And you'll see real versions of these when you look through scopes in the lab eventually. The events for a plant, though, are the same. They have the same names, so I'm not going to go through it all again. Well, here we don't have a eukaryotic cell, which we've been focusing on. This is a prokaryotic cell, and E. coli is a bacterium, which, of course, is prokaryotic. And so there is no compartmentalization in a prokaryotic cell because they don't have a nucleus. But just because they don't have a nucleus doesn't mean they don't have DNA. They can't live without DNA because they still need to know how to build the proteins required to live their life. That's what DNA is all about. Well, the DNA is not in the form of multiple chromosomes like it is for eukaryotes. Each species has some number of chromosomes. For a typical prokaryote, it's one chromosome. And instead of it being a linear one with two ends, in other words, it's one loop. It's a circular chromosome. So what looks like a tangle of spaghetti here is all, if you carefully manipulated it, would be all one loop, one chromosome. Just like a eukaryotic cell needs to give both of its daughter cells a full DNA library, so does a prokaryotic cell. So it also has to go through a DNA replication step first before it can start splitting. But when it does split, it does not do so via mitosis, because I've already told you mitosis is division of a nucleus. A prokaryotic cell doesn't have a nucleus. So cell division in a prokaryote is a simpler process since it's just one compartment, and it happens by a process called binary fission. Binary simply means in two. Fission means splitting. A fissure is a split. Well, what you see in the middle here before the split is two identical circular chromosomes because replication has already occurred. So this is enough material for two cells, but it's soon to be two cells. It then undergoes something similar to cytokinesis, but it's just called binary fission, and each cell gets one of the two identical copies of the chromosome. The lifetime of a bacterium, by the way, is relatively short from our point of view. It can be, if there's food available, it can be 20 minutes. That's the entire lifetime of a bacterium, which means every 20 minutes, however many bacteria are there, doubles. And that gets out of hand quickly, which is why there's so many bacteria. Okay, in 11, we're comparing what we just looked at, which is binary fission, as in a bacterium, for instance, to what we looked at before that, which is mitosis and cytokinesis in most eukaryotes, including us, ants, animals, and plants. But there are also other eukaryotic organisms that aren't animals or plants that still undergo cell division, still undergo mitosis and cytokinesis. But mitosis happens a little bit different in some of these groups. For instance, in dinoflagellates, you can see that the nuclear envelope does not disintegrate like it does in us. Remember, I said it has to in us because it's in the way. Well, it's in the way for them as well, except they've solved this problem by having holes in the nuclear envelope through which microtubules grow. And in other types, diatoms, which live in the ocean, The difference here is that they don't need to disintegrate their nuclear envelope because their centrosomes are actually inside their nucleus to begin with. So it's not in the way of anything. But other than those differences, they're functionally speaking, the goal is the same, and the same thing happens for mitosis. Okay, well, that brings us to 12. And we've already looked at what happens in cell division, mitosis and cytokinesis, or in the cell cycle, to put it more tersely. Now the question is, how does a cell know to progress through the subphases? In other words, how is the cell cycle controlled? Well, it was reasonable back before we knew anything about it, and we're still learning about this. We definitely don't know all the details even still, but it was reasonable to guess that there's probably some sort of chemical signal involved telling cells, okay, it's time to go from G1 to S or whatever, to progress through the cell cycle, in other words. But you can't, in science, just say, this makes sense, so let's believe it. You have to demonstrate it, right? Well, in this experiment, what they did in experiment one is to fuse a cell in S with a cell in G1. Remember that G1 is earlier than S, right? And when they did that, they noticed that the formerly G1 half immediately started replicating its DNA, which is pretty good evidence that there's some chemical that this S thing has that's spurring the other half into S as well. It's pretty good evidence that there's a chemical signal. It doesn't tell you at all what it is. But even better evidence is shown in experiment two. Because G1, you know, is leading to S normally. They could have just gotten lucky. But in experiment two, they took an M cell and fused it with G1. Now, G1 is nowhere close to M, right? It has to get through S and G2 before it can go into M, which is cell division. And when they did that, this formerly G1 cell started trying to divide. It started to undergo mitosis, even though it couldn't because its chromosomes weren't replicated. You can't split it into two chromatids when there aren't even two chromatids. So a cell wouldn't do that unless it got a signal that's abnormal, which is what it's getting from this more mature cell. That's much better evidence that there is a chemical basis to the control of the cell cycle. And we will actually, that's probably a good place to stop. We'll talk about what we know about the chemical basis of control, starting with slide 13 later.